This is case number 52640, Sims versus State, Martin Weiner on behalf of the appellant. You want to reserve any time, Mr. Weiner?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay. That means you'll have 10 minutes to present your argument. I'll remind you when it's 5 minutes.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here on such a historic occasion. I'd like to remind you, Justice Cherry and Justice Seda, that I also participate in another historic event with you two, which is the very first time that you heard an oral argument. It was me giving the initial argument. I hope I'm as successful today as I was then. This is a case in which appellant Stanley Zane Sims, he was victimized by an unscrupulous prosecutor and by a judge who approved what the prosecutor did and what the prosecutor wanted to do on at least 8 separate occasions in which injustices were caused to him. The first such was actually, I'd like to initially say my request is that Your Honors reverse the conviction of Mr. Sims and order that all charges be dismissed with prejudice so they could not be refiled against him. These 8 separate injustices, any one of them is sufficient to justify reversal, and even if any one of them isn't sufficient in itself, the cumulative effect of all 8 of these should lead to a reversal of the conviction. First, he was subjected to a sloppy, disorganized, tainted, and botched grand jury proceeding filled with a lack of justification for prosecuting him, a tainted evidence presented to the grand jury that was inadmissible, an incomplete indictment that left out facts concerning 2 of the essential elements, and there was no exculpatory evidence presented to the grand jury as requested by Mr. Sims. Then, number 2, the prosecutor, a very experienced prosecutor, walked away with overheads, documents, exhibits. There's a claim that there were 8 separate exhibits admitted. The prosecutor said there were 150 pages at least, and he walked away with them at the end of the grand jury proceeding, and their whereabouts was unknown for more than 2 months. During that time, it became impossible for anyone to know what were these documents, overheads, exhibits that were seen by the grand jury. Number 3, when Mr. Sims came to Judge Palaha and said, look, how can I file a pretrial writ to attack the decision of the grand jury here without knowing all the evidence? Please, let's determine what happened to the evidence, what was the evidence. Let's give me an opportunity to review all the evidence before you compel me to file a writ. And the judge said, no, you get no relief.
Was the evidence not in the discovery that you're complaining about?
Correct. The alleged grand jury exhibits did not appear until after I had to file my pretrial writ of habeas corpus, and I believe it perhaps was not delivered until it was submitted to the judge for decision.
Well, what is the policy in Washoe County as far as discovery at this stage of the proceedings, when either a criminal complaint is filed in the justice court or there's going to be a grand jury proceeding? What do they do in Washoe County?
Well, when my client appears for the first time in front of the district court and enters his not guilty plea, a discovery order is entered, and then we eventually get discovery. But there was a pile of hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents with no clue as to which ones were examined by the by the witnesses, nor which ones were reviewed by the grand jurors themselves.
Is this a case where a criminal complaint was not originally filed and then a grand jury indictment?
That's correct. They went directly to indictment.
Yeah, Mr. Weiner, let me ask you this, and we'll go into a couple areas maybe that are unperipherally involved here. I think it might be some interest to the students. I know when I was a district judge, I dismissed an indictment on a murder case on a 15-year-old boy who was charged with killing his father, and there were some irregularities in the grand jury proceedings, and I concluded similar to what you argued in this case, that the indictment had to be dismissed. So this 15-year-old was in court, and he walked outside the courtroom, and he was immediately arrested by the police as soon as I dismissed the indictment, and it based upon a new criminal complaint being filed. So in other words, the DA said, no big deal. We'll just start over again, and we'll proceed, instead of through the grand jury, we'll proceed through the justice court system and file a criminal complaint and ask him to be held for a preliminary hearing in justice court. So is that something, I know you've argued that it should be dismissed with prejudice, meaning the DA wouldn't be able to refile the charges if we agreed with that, but isn't this something that's kind of a technical violation that the DA could just start again here, or what's your position on that?
There's a case law on this. I think it was Nye County versus Davis, cited in my opening brief and reply brief, that says if the prosecutor substantially ignores procedural rights of a defendant, that the case should be dismissed and cannot be refiled. That was the attempt in the Nye County Sheriff versus Davis. Also, I believe it was the Keeney case that also discussed as a tool that a dismissal with prejudice is appropriate if there's prejudice to the defendant, and we demonstrated numerous areas in which he was prejudiced, but even if there isn't any prejudice, as a prophylactic tool to prevent future misconduct of this kind. I cited the Cronin case where an attorney was disqualified from representing his client because he interviewed a witness who he shouldn't have interviewed, who was an employee of the defendant corporation. That case rang like a loud bell through the plaintiff's litigation community, and there have not been any, at least, repeat cases of that nature. And so even though the consequences to lawyer Cronin were terrible, it served the purpose. It was prophylactic. It taught everybody that this is a deterrence. Don't do this. There is no basis that would allow the prosecutor in this case to walk away with the grand jury exhibits that disadvantages you three justices, because how can you do what the function is, which is to determine, based on all the evidence taken together, whether the grand jury made the right decision? You don't have all the evidence. You never will, because the stenographer was not given custody of those exhibits.
But, Mr. Weiner, isn't it true that we have an official transcript of those proceedings? And, in fact, isn't there case law that suggests that, given even the absence of a grand juror, that with the official transcript, that grand juror can still vote? And, moreover, given the official transcript, in fact, a grand juror or a reviewing court can see exactly what was presented. The testimony, of course, is taken under oath. Is that sufficient?
Well, I would say your question has two parts. First of all, the grand jury can perform its function. They didn't know the prosecutor was going to leave with all the exhibits after they made their decision. The question for the reviewing court is the statutes 172.145 and .155 require the grand jury to consider all the evidence taken together. The district judge has to consider whether the grand jury, in considering all the evidence taken together, made a correct decision. But we don't have all the evidence. It's no different than if the prosecutor had walked off with a large chunk of the court stenographer's notes, and that couldn't be transcribed.
That's not what happened here, and that's really the essence of my question. In fact, if we have the certified transcript of the proceeding, isn't that sufficient?
No, because we don't know what documents were reviewed by the grand jurors. They are not in the transcript. And we don't know what documents were being identified and testified to by the witnesses whose testimony appears in the grand jury transcript.
And you don't believe that that is adequately set forth in the transcript of their testimony? I am looking at X document. I certify or I authenticate that this is X.
No, the documents, that's why it was so sloppy and disorganized, because they were not identified by number. They were not described. They were just shown to the witness, who would answer questions about this mysterious document, and who knows what the grand jurors reviewed. In that could have been exculpatory evidence. Notes saying there's no requirement for Mr. Sims to put the money in a trust account. That's a red herring. That's got no relation to anything he's charged with. In fact, that was the kind of prejudicial information presented to the grand jury that the Franklin case said. It's not simply a question of ignoring the inadmissible evidence in deciding whether the grand jury acted correctly. This inadmissible evidence can poison the grand jury to the point where the result is tainted forever. And under Franklin, that's what happened here. Additionally, I think it's Shelby versus District Court says it's the burden of the prosecutor to justify that the grand jury acted correctly. How can the prosecutor do that when all the evidence viewed by the grand jurors is not available for review? I say there was no possible way for Judge Palaha to decide that the prosecutor carried his burden to prove probable cause based on all the evidence.
Now, Mr. Weiner, and hopefully Justice Chair will give you a little extra time because we've got a lot of questions here, but in this particular case, can we talk about the standard of review, what we have to look at? For example, let's say the three of us were former trial judges, and maybe we don't agree with Judge Palaha's ruling. We would have agreed with you at your argument if we were sitting in a district court, but if the standard of review is whether or not Judge Palaha abuses discretion on any of these issues, then it's a different review process we have to go through? Or do you think it should be de novo review, meaning can we take a fresh look at it like we were sitting in court right now?
I think the case law is that it has to be a de novo review of you reviewing it yourself rather than deciding was Judge Palaha right on the probable cause issue. The Frutiger case and the Middleton case are two in which the Supreme Court reviewed the sufficiency of the evidence to require those defendants to go to trial, and I believe decided in both cases there was insufficient evidence, so it's a de novo review. That's what I believe. Okay. And of course, what Judge Palaha did, in addition to denying the writ of habeas corpus, was to approve the misconduct by the prosecutor by saying, no, I won't disqualify you, no, I won't dismiss this case. I asked for a couple of minutes to reserve. I'm a little unclear where I'm actually at. I had asked for 5 minutes for.
I'll give you four.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to sit down now. Okay. Reserve. Thank you.
Joseph R. Plater is a district attorney from Washoe County. Mr. Plater, for the state of Nevada.
May it please the court, counsel? I'd like to first address your question, Justice Gibbons, about the standard of review. Judge Palaha denied the motions and the petition for writ of habeas corpus that Mr. Sims brought. And so the question is, what standard of review, or how are you supposed to look at the ruling Justice Palaha made? And we submit that standard should be for an abuse of discretion or clear error. In other words, did Judge Palaha commit clear error? Did he clearly abuse his discretion when he made his ruling? And we base that argument on the idea that this court has said that when reviewing whether the district court correctly determined whether there was probable cause, for example, whether a magistrate had probable cause to issue a search warrant, the standard of review is substantial evidence or an abuse of discretion. Now, admittedly, the case that we cite, Wright v. State, concerns review of probable cause insofar as a search warrant is concerned. But the idea is the same. You're reviewing the district court's determination whether there was probable cause for the grand jury to indict Mr. Sims. Because after all, that's the bottom line. The bottom line, according to Franklin, well, according to the case law in this state since 1865 through Franklin and beyond, is that whenever you have a grand jury proceeding, the question at the end of the day is there probable cause, despite any other error that occurred? Now, Mr. Weiner's argument is that there can be error of such a magnitude that it taints the whole proceeding, that even if there was probable cause, if the misconduct is so egregious, that would taint the grand jury proceeding, and you should dismiss the true bill with prejudice, or dismiss the indictment with prejudice, and preclude the state from prosecuting Mr. Sims again. That's not what Franklin holds. In Franklin, the court was concerned about some inadmissible tapes, some tapes that police officers had procured and that were done unlawfully. And the court said, well, you know, regardless of what the tapes show, we're going to analyze the taint by whether there is still probable cause to sustain the indictment. So when the court uses the language that we're going to consider the taint that might have possibly occurred at a grand jury proceeding, What the court is saying is that it will review that taint by asking the question, does there still exist probable cause to sustain the indictment? In this case, there is. There's no question about it. So we would contend whether you use an abusive discretion standard or a de novo review, when you read the grand jury testimony, put all the exhibits aside that he maintains we unlawfully took from the grand jury proceeding. And when you look at the testimony of the people, we have testimony from the individuals and a fleet manager and an assistant fleet manager from the two dealers in Arizona who all came before the grand jury and said, these people gave their money to Mr. Sims to buy an automobile. The people got their car, but the dealers didn't get paid. He took the money and did something else with it, and that constitutes embezzlement.
Mr. Plater, could you talk a little bit about how much evidence do you have to present at a grand jury to secure an indictment? And I might add, my colleague Justice Cherry was a criminal defense attorney for many years, and he used to always make a joke whenever I heard him speak that it's so easy to get an indictment at a grand jury, you could indict a ham sandwich. So what does the state actually have to show in order to secure an indictment from a grand jury?
When the state went to the grand jury in this case, the state has to show that Mr. Sims committed embezzlement by a probable cause standard. The state is not trying to prove that Mr. Sims is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the standard that the state would have once we went to trial and we're going to prove the case to a jury of 12 people. That standard would be beyond a reasonable doubt. The standard in front of a grand jury is that we just have to show probable cause. This court has said that you can show probable cause by slight or marginal evidence. The grand jury doesn't have to hear any evidence from the defendant, and it doesn't have to worry about whether there are any innocent explanations for the defendant's conduct, as long as there appears at least enough evidence to show that he probably committed the crime. And so we have that lesser standard to get the case initiated. It just initiates the charge against the defendant in the district court. Once we go to trial, we have to meet that higher burden.
Thank you.
Mr. Plater, quick question. There is some allegation that we need to create, if the district court rule itself doesn't provide for this, about depositing witness exhibits and documents from the grand jury proceeding. DCR 11 suggests that there is a rule with respect to removal of those exhibits during a district court proceeding. What should this court, or should we at all, consider whether or not a rule at the grand jury level needs to be provided? Mm.
And I think the case does raise the issue. I'll suggest a number of approaches. Number one,
does that mean then if you're suggesting approaches that you would agree that there is no rule presently to cover the preservation of exhibits or removal of exhibits at the grand jury level?
I think there is no rule. There's no case law, there's no rule, there's no regulation that tells a district attorney when he goes to the grand jury and after the grand jury reaches its decision that he then has to do something with the documents. And I'm not even sure what Mr. Sims is saying we should have done in this case. Is he saying we should have left the documents with the grand jury? Who on the grand jury? The foreman? With the stenographer? With the clerk of the court? And how are we supposed to do that? Was the clerk of the court supposed to have come into the grand jury room where that person's not necessarily authorized by statute to be there? Or are we supposed to take the exhibits after the grand jury proceeding and take them over to the district court clerk's office? And if so, and if that is the rule that we were under at that time, why couldn't we do it now? We could still go do it. The idea is that somehow we walked off with these exhibits and we have compromised their integrity. But there's no evidence to that. And in fact, I would say you had an office. Mr. Wiener has the exhibits. Mr. Hall sent the exhibits to his office where his, I believe it was his receptionist, signed off for the receipt of those exhibits. And Mr. Hall is an officer of the court. I think the rule in this case should be that when a lawyer such as Mr. Hall, the prosecutor, conducted the grand jury hearing, he presented the exhibits, he then gave those exhibits as an officer of the court to Mr. Wiener, and Mr. Wiener, as the record shows, acknowledged receipt of those exhibits, there's a presumption that those exhibits are what we said they were at the grand jury hearing. And if he disagrees, He can come into a writ proceeding like he did in this case and challenge their authenticity. If he thinks they're not all there, there's something different than what they are, the grand jury didn't have a chance to consider them, he can call those witnesses, put them back up on the stand, and ask them, is this what was presented? But I think we should have a presumption that they were there. There's no rule that now expressly or explicitly tells a district attorney that he has to leave the exhibits with somebody or in some place after a proceeding. So I don't think you even have to reach the question in this case, because he had the exhibits and there's no idea that they were compromised in any fashion. If we were supposed to have left them, again, I suggest with somebody, we could still do it. If we were negligent in not leaving them with somebody and we can't deposit them right now with the clerk of the court, the error is harmless.
Well, Mr. Pyer, one concern I have following up on what Justice Sata said is the state has the choice of how to pursue felony or gross misdemeanor charges against a defendant. You can choose to either go to the grand jury or you can choose to file a criminal complaint in justice court and proceed that way, and the defense doesn't have any choice. You know, they're stuck with whatever the state does. So if the state elects to do it through the grand jury, should the state be very careful? Because likewise, let's say this case was in Fallon and the complaint were filed in justice court, then Judge Richards would get the case. He'd get all the exhibits through his court clerk. They would safeguard them in the system, and then if he bound the defendant over to district court to Judge Huff, then they'd be sent right to Judge Huff, and the court would be able to safeguard all those exhibits all the time. So should we have a rule similar to that as far as grand jury to make sure everything's safeguarded?
I think the court could promulgate such a rule. You could adopt in the district court rules themselves, or have the local districts adopt their own rules and have it approved by this court. I think you could go ahead and do that. Okay. The question in this case, was there error of such a magnitude that it should be reversed or that it should be dismissed with prejudice? I don't think so. Now, I want to add one other thing. Mr. Weiner, as I said, he has all those exhibits because we took them to his office, and he's put them in the record on appeal. You have them. And, in fact, they're even marked. They're marked with the grand jury exhibit. There's State's Exhibit 7 or 8, I just noticed in my record on appeal in the appendix.
So your point is if there was a mistake, it's harmless because it's been subsequently cured.
Well, it's harmless in that we didn't need any of those exhibits to indict him in the first place. The testimony of the witnesses is sufficient by itself to sustain all of those five charges against him. Mm-hmm. And Franklin tells us that if there was a mistake in not being able to present the exhibits after the fact, that if there's probable cause within the grand jury proceeding itself, then the error is harmless. But it's also harmless in that there's never been any showing that the exhibits that we presented to the court aren't the ones that we presented to the grand jury. Because as I said, Mr. Hall is an officer of the court. He said, here they are. I think the presumption of regularity or integrity of the exhibits should be maintained until he comes forward with evidence showing that they aren't.
Now, the other thing I want to ask you, this case is a little unusual factually because in this case, Mr. Sims has already pled guilty to a charge and has been sentenced and has received probation. It's kind of unusual we would get the case in the Supreme Court when it's really already been resolved. How did that come about?
Yeah, it is unusual, Justice Gibbs, because normally the rule of law is once you plead guilty, you waive all of the constitutional claims or other claims, usually, once you plead guilty, and you can't raise those claims anymore, even on appeal, because you've admitted your guilt. You've admitted your guilt. There's nothing else to argue about. There's some exceptions to that. You can argue a few things after you plead guilty, such as did the court consider impalpable suspect evidence at sentencing? Was there an abuse of discretion?
But the state agreed with Mr. Weiner that when Mr. Sims made his guilty plea, he'd still have a right to the full appeal, and then if he won the appeal, then the charges could conceivably
be
dismissed.
The state agreed in this case that if you plead guilty, we'll allow you to raise some of these same issues that you've raised in front of the district court again, just to resolve the case and get it over with, hopefully.
Okay. Thank you.
And then finally, I want to also say, as far as these exhibits are concerned, Mr. Hall identified the exhibits at the end of the grand jury proceeding, and that's in the transcript. He identified them briefly and referred to what they were in front of the grand jury. And since he did that, and he identified them by number, and since we have those exhibits in the record on appeal contained in the appendix, again, we can be comfortable that we have everything that the grand jury saw, and so that the district court had a clear idea of what it was reviewing when the grand jury reviewed the case.
Anything further, Mr. Blair?
Unless you have any other questions.
Any questions?
I do have one. Judge Palaha, after the grand jury returned an indictment, there was an amendment to the indictment. Can the judges do that, or is that something that should be left to the grand jury determining the specific language of the indictment?
What happened here, Justice Gibbons, is that the indictment alleged that Mr. Sims converted his client's money with the intent to defraud the money, to steal it, that he had a criminal intent to do something, and it also alleged at the same time that he used the money in a way different from which it was given or entrusted to him from his clients. So, as you know, our embezzlement statute has two different species that the court has referred to it as. There's two different kinds of embezzlement under our embezzlement statute. The indictment language alleges both kinds of embezzlement. So in front of Judge Palaha, the deputy district attorney said, you know what, we don't want to pursue the criminal intent species of embezzlement, the first kind of embezzlement that's mentioned in the statute. We want to just go under the second kind. The second kind of embezzlement says that we can prosecute you if you use somebody's money or property in a way that's different from the way that you entrusted that property with us. And that we went under that way. Now, there was an objection by Mr. Weiner, and the court said, well, I'm going to strike the criminal intent kind, and I'm going to let the state go on the second kind of embezzlement. That was proper because the evidence in front of the grand jury showed both kinds, at least by a probable cause standard. And yes, under Pansy v. State, if there's evidence presented, say, at a preliminary hearing that justifies the charge, you can amend the charge to reflect the proof that was given at the hearing. So either that or it was just surplusage, which under statute we can strike. The district court was correct in amending the statute.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Weiner. Mr. Weiner, you have 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Mr. Weiner, as you approach, I'd like you to contemplate this question, and that would be, assuming that we buy your suggestion that this was a sloppy grand jury that was tainted in several ways, what prejudice to your client is before us now that we should consider?
Von Brinken says the purpose of a probable cause determination is to avoid a person from being subject to the indignity and terrible experience, I'm paraphrasing, of having to go to trial. And the problem here is that Mr. Sims was compelled to go to trial based on this. Basically, it's a fraudulent proceeding in front of the grand jury, because part of the evidence that should have been, contrary to what Mr. Plater says, there are statutes that say when a transcript is filed, this is NRS 172.225, quote, any related physical evidence exhibited to the grand jury becomes a matter of public record. Now, you don't have to be a brain surgeon to figure out that being a matter of public record doesn't mean a prosecutor can take something back to his office for more than 2 months. Now, this talk about, an officer of the court. I was here in a case, State v. District Court, that's been subtitled the Epperson case. Epperson is a case in which a district judge said, even though this was a child pornography case, I, as the defense attorney, was entitled to get copies of that material to defend my client. And the Supreme Court in the Epperson case, that was 120 Nevada 254, had a whole array of rules limiting what I was allowed to do with this, and this was just a copy. This was not the original. So if I can't be trusted by the Supreme Court to handle a copy of the evidence, why should a prosecutor be trusted to have the original evidence that should have been a matter of public record, and Epperson had nothing to do with matters of public record. It's just wrong.
Mr. Weiner, yeah. Epperson, though, I think I was on that case. Child pornography, though, has certain special rules, you know, like that. And child pornography could be a picture of somebody under 18 sent on a cell phone. That could be child pornography, and they can go to prison for life. There's life in prison for sending that picture, or for somebody keeping that picture on their cell phone. Life in prison.
I know.
Like that. So there's a special set of rules for that. So how would you distinguish that from this case here?
Well, there is no distinguishing it, except that an officer of the court, an attorney, had to have particular requirements set out, six or seven by the Supreme Court, limiting my ability to handle that copy. So if Epperson is good for the defense, then what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and there is rules, Your Honor, Justice Sater. There is a rule, 172.225. It's a matter of public record. How can an experienced prosecutor believe that allows him to take it back to his office or wherever it was? Now, there were 140-some pages. Seven of them had an exhibit mark on it. Why is it my job to prove that these are not the official exhibits? I wasn't there at the grand jury. Defense attorney cannot be there. Mr. Sims could not be there. Why is it my burden to do it? It should be the burden of the prosecutor to establish that these were the grand jury exhibits. They never did it. They never called any of the court reporter to authenticate these exhibit marks. I have never said that I believe those are the grand jury exhibits. I have no idea. I wasn't there. I don't have a clue. And so to say that we have the grand jury exhibits, that just violates all the integrity of the grand jury process. That's the reason they have a transcript. That's the reason that this was required.
Mr. Wayne, let me ask you one other question, too.
Sure.
Maybe just to give you a little more time again. I'm talkative today. But let's say Mr. Sims had got these cars up from Arizona. Let's say he sold it to a Fallon High School student that just turned 16 and got their first car, and they paid good money for the car, and he couldn't give them ownership papers. So they're out the money. Should Mr. Sims potentially go to jail for that, or should that be restricted to the student being able to make a civil suit, meaning ask for money recovery? What's the proper way to deal with a situation like that?
I'll tell you what the evidence was below. First of all, that if the dealers in Arizona followed the law, they would have provided titles to Mr. Sims' customers, whether or not they got paid. That was in the grand jury transcript, page 19 or 20. Secondly, there was evidence that we presented to the prosecutor and asked for it to be presented to the grand jury, explain away evidence, including the fact that the Department of Motor Vehicles can provide substitute title in a case like this, but they didn't do that. So those are two ways in which the Fallon student would be protected here. And also, businesses fail. Greece is about ready to file for bankruptcy. So how can you expect, nobody's accusing them of crimes. People make promises that they can't keep because
you're talking
of financial
about the
problems.
The country of Greece in Europe, is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
And that was the movie Greece, because I know they had some.
We just saw that, yes.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with bankruptcy.
Okay.
But here's another thing. You get a credit card. The credit card company extends you credit. You buy materials. You can't pay your credit card bill. That's what bankruptcy court is for. No one is accusing those who own the credit cards of fraud. And the most important thing here is the original indictment was defective. It never told Mr. Sims what the customers wanted him to do with the money except to go get a car, which he did. The indictment didn't allege what the entrustment instructions were. Maybe they're in the missing exhibits, maybe they're not. And then when Judge Palaha decided to rewrite the indictment, I've never heard of the Panzi case. I don't see it cited in any of counsel's pleadings. And counsel had his opportunity to justify this rewriting of the indictment. That invades the province of the grand jury, which is forbidden. And not only that, what Judge Palaha did was he threw out elements of the offense that were found by the grand jury, that Mr. Sims was a bailee. So the bailee-specific requirements applied to him. I thoroughly briefed the fact that the embezzlement statute is a hopeless mess, and personally, I think that what it should be done here is that the part of the statute that allows misuse of property to be an actionable felony doesn't comport with the Walsh case that this court has issued that says you must have an intent to steal. But what that would mean is that if I borrowed your car and you said bring it back by 10 and I bring it back by 10:15, I've committed the crime of embezzlement because I used it in a manner and a purpose that you did not authorize me to do, and I don't believe that comports with the statutes. I believe it's chapter 190 and 197 that says you need to have a criminal intent to be convicted of a crime.
No, I understand your point in the way the statutes are written, but here's my concern. You know, we don't write the statutes, the legislature does, and people don't realize maybe the judges are the most powerful people in the country because we can say the statutes are invalid, and who knows, maybe we got rid of the legislature and the governor, you know, like that, and we can let the judges run things. But a lot of people think it's a really bad idea. So
we'll take a vote on that.
But we have to generally, we have to follow the statutes because the legislature passes them. We have to presume they're valid. So
I see. What I'm saying, though, even if you decide the embezzlement statute is valid, the way it was in which it was applied here, it's either ambiguous, which means it must be interpreted in the way most favorable to Mr. Sims, or if it's clear and unambiguous, then apply the language that was put in the indictment by the grand jury. And in fact, you could see at page 3 of the appendix, Mr. Hall himself drafted the indictment before there was any evidence presented to the grand jury. So he did it himself. He's the one who put in there that the defendant is a bailee, that the defendant converted it to his own use, and that the defendant had an intent to defraud. And what Judge Palaha did was say, I'm tossing out intent to defraud, I'm tossing out convert, and I'm even tossing out that he's a bailee. And if you take a look at the embezzlement statute, subsection 4, 205.300, everybody is a bailee. And if everybody's a bailee, then the bailee-specific definition requiring conversion and intent to defraud would apply to everybody. There is no one who's not a bailee who fits under the embezzlement statute.
Mr. Wiener, I have to cut you off.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both to Mr. Plater, Mr. Wiener, and ladies and gentlemen, could we give these attorneys a round of applause?
We could take questions or
I have another break in the class. 10 minutes over.
Okay.
This case will stand submitted.